It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania lawmakers are gearing up for a once-in-a-decade redistricting battle where a select group will decide where to draw new boundaries for the state's legislative districts. The Redistricting Commission has five members. Each of the four legislative leaders appoint one, usually themselves, and the fifth is appointed to possibly break ties. This year, you could have applied for that fifth spot. Marie Albigez has been covering the redistricting process for Spotlight PA and VoteBeat. Marie, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me again.
So this is the second time in five decades that the commission has opened up this position to applicants. Why?
This redistricting process has largely been done in secret over the decades. You know, legislators draw their own lines and they like to keep it secret. And for the first time last decade was really when the public got a little bit more involved. They were able to comment on the proposed maps. They were able to attend public hearings. And for the first time, they were able to apply to be that fifth member who is also going to be the chair and could possibly decide, be the deciding vote on those maps. And so this time around, the four current members of the Redistricting Commission have pledged transparency and they have pledged for an open process. And they have once again opened up the floor to consider the public for that fifth member. And now whether they will actually choose someone from that list will be determined in a future date.
And of course, they're drawing lots of lines, 203 House district lines and 50 state Senate lines.
That's right. They're drawing, you know, our state House and Senate districts that really impact the bills that they consider and the issues that really impact us on a day-to-day basis.
If there's no agreement among the four on a chair for this panel, how is that person then selected?
The Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, will then select that person if the four commission members cannot come to an agreement. And we've seen that happen four out of the five last decades.
I believe 10 years ago, the fifth member was a retired judge. Who typically are the past chairs of this panel?
That's right. We've had past judges, and then we've had a lot of deans of university law schools. We've had attorneys. So the list is filled with people with a lot of legal experience.
Have they said what sort of qualities they are looking this time around for the fifth member who might have to break a tie?
They've given us some vague ideas about what kind of person they want to be in this spot. You know, one said that they want to have a neutral arbiter who holds the same values and commitments to having an open and transparent process. Another member said that they want someone who can provide fair representation for the decade to come. Another said that they want someone who shares their commitment to ensure that power remains in the hands of the voters. So really the only legal requirements are that the chair be a citizen of Pennsylvania who doesn't hold a paid local, state, or federal office. So beyond that, the door's kind of wide open.
There's a bill that anti-gerrymandering groups have been pushing for this commission. It's sponsored by State Senator David Argall. It puts limits on who can serve. What are some of those limits?
Sure. So most of the limits are around whether the chair is registered lobbyist or if their spouse is a registered lobbyist that, within the last 5 years, then they can't apply. It also restricts people who have been political candidates in the past 5 years, and as well as people themselves or their spouses who have worked for political campaigns or worked for other candidates.
Is there time to pass this bill and still be able to appoint that fifth member of this commission, which is what, the end of this month?
That's right. They have until April 30th, and it's really not looking like there's going to be enough time. The bill passed unanimously out of the Senate committee last month, but the Senate isn't in session again until April 17th. And so it's still, you know, if it does get considered by the Senate, then it would still have to go through the entire House process, as well as get approval from the governor. So the likelihood of that all happening before April 30th is a little bit tricky. But, you know, at the same time, the commission could take on this additional criteria as they're considering their fifth member without necessarily having that bill in law.
The delay in result in the U.S. Census could cause problems for this legislative reapportionment commission. We spoke with you about this very issue before. Do we know where things stand with the census data?
Yes. So we know that we won't get that redistricting data until September 30th. Now, there is something called legacy data that is supposed to be coming out around August 15th or August 30th. It's basically the same redistricting data, but it's in a harder to use format. And so the staffers that are processing this data would have to do a little bit more work on the back end before it's kind of user friendly and ready to be used. I don't know yet if the commissioners will take and use that legacy data or if they'll wait until September 30th. But, you know, regardless of when we get the data, the advocates that are pushing for transparency and reform say that they are hopeful and they are excited about some of the transparency measures that the commission has put forth so far, including the application process. They also point to a brand new redesigned redistricting website that the commission put out that has legislative maps and congressional maps dating back to the early 1900s. So it sounds like they are hopeful that there will be more transparency and more public involvement this time around.
You wrote about how partisanship is at an all-time high in Harrisburg. We have a Republican-controlled legislature and, of course, a Democratic governor. So why open this process up if it seems maybe unlikely there will be consensus?
You know, last decade, we had a Republican trifecta where we had, Republican-controlled legislature, Republican governor, and Republicans also controlled the Supreme Court. This time around, there's a little bit more bipartisanship already kind of baked into the process. We've got the bipartisanship with the four members. Depending on the fifth member that they pick, there could be, you know, even more bipartisanship. If they can't agree to a fifth member, then the Democratic-led Supreme Court will pick that member. Now, whether they decide to pick someone who would be in favor of drawing the maps to lean more for Democrats, that's, you know, something that we're waiting to see. So there's all these kind of checks and balances that we're dealing with that we really didn't see last decade.
Marie Albages is a reporter with Spotlight PA and VoteBeat. Marie, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. A lawsuit has been filed against the U.S. Department of Education on behalf of 33 current and former students at federally funded Christian colleges and universities. The suit claims discriminatory practices at these institutions are unconstitutional because they accept federal funds. With us is Paul Southwick. He's one of the attorneys that filed the suit and the director of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So in your lawsuit, all of the colleges are Christian colleges, but are there any non-Christian federally funded institutions that exist?
I use the word Christian in a very broad sense to include both the LDS affiliated institutions as well as Seventh-day Adventists. Sometimes those institutions like to consider themselves not part of broader Christianity necessarily. But outside the realm of Christianity, there are a few. Probably the most famous one is Yeshiva University in New York City.
So talking about these schools, how much federal money do these schools take in?
It's billions. And as an example of that, Liberty University alone, one single institution, receives about $1 billion annually itself from the federal government. Now, a lot of that money is from the Department of Education through government subsidized loans. Some of the money is direct grants.
So just to clarify, the money that you're talking about, it comes in the form of federal loans given to students that they then pay to the university?
That's correct. The bulk of the money is federal funding that flows through students to attend the college of their choice. But the flow of that money has some strings attached, and that's where Title IX comes in. So if there's any money that's going to an institution that participates in federal student loan programs, so Pell Grants or, you know, unsubsidized or subsidized loans, all those kinds of things, then they have to follow Title IX unless there's some sort of exemption for them. And that's kind of where where our case comes in.
The exemption is just for any institution that claims to be religious, or do they have to meet some type of criteria?
Well, the answer to that has evolved over time. Different administrations have different approaches to that. When the religious exemption was first enacted as part of the Title IX apparatus, the concern for largely evangelical Christian colleges at the time was they wanted to restrict certain degree programs to men only, or if a woman became pregnant and was not married, they wanted to be able to expel her. Then under the Obama administration, once Title IX was interpreted to protect trans and queer students, there was this new wave of religious exemptions. And so they really scrambled for a bit. And it wasn't until the Trump administration that new regulations at the last minute were put into place that pretty much say, if you're somewhat religious and you have some kind of belief that doesn't align with any aspect of Title IX, you get an exemption and you don't even have to ask for it. You just have it inherently.
So what you're hoping the outcome of this lawsuit will be is that the religious exemption in Title IX is eliminated. That's correct, right?
Not quite, but eliminated as applied to queer and trans students. You can challenge a statute either on its face and get rid of the whole thing, which is a harder legal hurdle, or you can challenge it as applied to a discrete class of people who you can more easily prove are being harmed.
Paul Southwick is one of the attorneys that filed the suit against the U.S. Department of Education and the director of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Mary Lee. Take care.
With us is Gary Campbell, one of the plaintiffs in this case and a former student at Clark Summit University, which was formerly known as Baptist Bible College. Welcome to the Confluence, Gary.
How you doing?
What made you want to attend what was then called Baptist Bible College?
At that time, I was essentially a different person. I was under the impression that in order to please God, I had to attend the Bible college, and two, had to pretty much change my sexuality. So that was just really a teenager just trying to live his best life. Well, he knew what that was.
So when you decided to enroll, did your family and church community know that you were gay, or was that something that you kind of came to later?
I told my pastoral staff and my family that I was gay, but we were all on the same page that I would attend therapy. They didn't call it conversion therapy, but looking back, it was definitely that.
You talked about the treatment that you received prior to attending the university, but this treatment, you said it continued when you went to university.
It was agreed upon that I would go once I got to the school. They were very concerned, me living in a dorm with 59 other guys, being a Christian who struggles with homosexuality. That's the verbiage they used. So they were pretty persistent. They're like, all right, once you get there, you have to find accountability. You have to seek counseling. In my sophomore year, I met another student who had the same, struggle, quote unquote, that I did. We ended up being intimate, and not like, it was just like kissing, but the school found out about it. And after that, the fallout, I had to go to actual counseling, group therapy, all out of pocket too. They got real serious after that.
Could you ever, relax at the school?
Now that you mention that, I didn't. And I was constantly under watch. I mean, and even like interacting with guys on a regular platonic level, I was looked at. I was under a microscope. Looking back, like I still feel like anytime somebody asks me like a question about my life or like what I'm doing, I get kind of like anxiety, because it's almost like a trauma response to that kind of treatment when you're under so much pressure for 3 years.
You eventually left the school. What was the kind of catalyst for the decision to finally walk away?
When they told me I couldn't live off campus, and then they said, okay, you can live off campus, we have to go half time. There was an alarm that went off. So I ended up going to the admissions counselor saying, hey, like, I'm going to leave and move back home to go to community college. And he's like, oh, we don't want that. And I'm like, well, this is what's going on behind the scenes. And he's like, well, somebody's making decisions that shouldn't be making those decisions. And he's like, if you leave, it's going to make our retention rate look bad. So what can we do to keep you to stay? I'm like, all right. I was like, you know, at this point, nobody's on the same page. You guys are messing with my head. This is creating a lot of stress. I just want to go home.
You decided you wanted to try to re-enroll at the university.
It was one of the promises I made starting recovery from alcohol was, all right, I'm going to finish my degree because that's just something I want to do to, you know, like who I am in the mirror again. And so I called the school and I said, hey, like, you know, how many more credits do I need to finish? They're like, oh, you just need 6 more credits. And, you know, better news yet, you can do it online because we have an online class now. I'm like, whoa, this is amazing. And 2 weeks later, the dean calls me to congratulate me. And then a week after that, he said, you know, it's come to our knowledge that you're still, you know, homosexual and, you know, we can't let you be a student here. So, and it really like, it was like a big punch in the gut, you know, because when you're trying to put your life back together and then you get that kind of news, it hurt really bad. And I haven't felt that much pain in a very long time. And I remember I asked him, I was like, is there any way to appeal that decision? And he's like, yeah, you can write a letter to the administration and go from there. And so I wrote a 2-page, very, very heartfelt letter just pleading to them as a human being, you know, I want to work in substance abuse. I want to make the world a better place. They responded in an email with one sentence, our policy cannot allow it. Yeah. So naturally, I went to the press because I was heated. I was pretty upset, but the press took the story, and then it went viral after that.
Gary Campbell is one of the 33 plaintiffs on the suit against the Department of Education. Gary, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We reached out to Clark Summit University for comment on what Gary says he experienced as a student. In a statement, a spokesperson said the university adheres to, quote, biblical standards and asks its students to do the same. The statement also said, quote, we believe students who have demonstrated financial need should continue to be given the freedom to choose the school that fits both their career and life goals, as well as their faith convictions, end quote.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.